And we will move on to our second case of the morning, which is number 082925, United States versus Anderson. Ms. Brennan.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Stephanie Brennan, and I represent Leslie Anderson in this case. Mr. Anderson challenges his conviction in connection with telemarketing fraud. And we raised two issues in our brief. One is a sufficiency of the evidence issue, and the other are a series of issues related to sentencing. I'd be pleased to answer any questions that the court has about the sufficiency issue, but if it's well laid out in our brief, and if it pleases the court, I would like to turn to some of the sentencing issues that we've raised. First, we challenged two of the sentencing enhancements that were applied by the district court. The first is that the court imposed a three-level enhancement, finding that Mr. Anderson was a manager or a supervisor under 3B1.1. And we think that this was erroneous. In particular, the court did not consider the issue of control over other participants. Under this court's precedent in the Faunes case, control over at least one other participant in the conspiracy is required in order to apply the enhancement, and that is consistent with Note 2 to the provision. And there was no evidence of control over participants presented, and no finding of control made by the U.S. District Court in imposing the enhancement. This court has not hesitated to find this type of enhancement erroneous where there's no control, even where an individual's participation in the crime is great.
In control of this operation for the period of time when the two primary actors were abroad, right?
That's a point I would like to address. That was what the court did focus on. There was a period of a few weeks where Mr. Anderson was behind while the two principals had gone on a vacation to Italy, and this was sort of toward the very end of the operation of this telemarketing scheme. And during that period, there was testimony that the two people that had been left to sort of man the ship were a man named Mr. Lennox and Mr. Anderson. The evidence, however, showed that Mr. Lennox and not Mr. Anderson actually controlled things during that short period of time. Mr. Lennox was the one who was running the operation. Mr. Anderson's participation during that time period was that he signed payroll checks because he was a signatory on the account. He also signed authorizations for wire transfers that were brought to him by Mr. Lennox. But Mr. Lennox testified that Mr. Anderson only signed what he told him to sign, and that he was in the background even during that period where he was supposedly managing or supervising. So we think that the finding during that very short period of time that he was actually exercising management or supervision authority was erroneous.
Ms. Brennan, could you speak at some point here as to this application note number 2, which appears to permit the district court to upwardly depart if the defendant, although not perhaps managing individuals, did participate in the management responsibility for the profits or the assets or the activities of the organization. It seems that this individual had a great deal to do with the management of the assets.
You're correct that that the government makes that argument, and they say that that's a reason that you would not have to reverse and remand. That, however, is not consistent with Gall, and it's not consistent with this court's decision in Faunes. They make very clear that even if the upward enhancement could have been applied, if the district court didn't do it and the district court improperly applied the three-level enhancement for being a manager or supervisor under 3B1.1, then this court is constrained to vacate and remand for a finding that an upward departure is appropriate.
In other words, if the district court did not apply the application note, we can't.
Correct. There has to be a remand, and the district court has to consider whether an upward enhancement, and the upward enhancement you're talking about is if there was management or supervision over property or the activities of the criminal enterprise as opposed to another participant in the crime. And that's a very key distinction. We think that the evidence in this case does not support any finding that there was control over another participant in the endeavor. Certainly, the evidence the evidence actually shows that other participants controlled Mr. Anderson. The Pagan case and the Mustriad case are good illustrations of this court vacating sentences where the three-level or four-level enhancement was applied. In those cases, the court found that where there was no real or direct influence on other participants, it's error to apply the enhancement. And that is the case here as well.
Does he have to have actually supervised, or does he simply have to have the authority to supervise?
I would submit that actual supervision or management is required. That seems to be what the purpose of the enhancement is to punish someone who actually is participating in the endeavor in the sense that they're managing or supervising others. And that is what we believe is required here.
Wasn't he at least part of the, if you want, directorate? There was seemed to be a group of people who got together every so often to kind of see how this whole operation was going on. He seemed to be part of that cabal.
Well, the evidence in the record is that he was present at three or four meetings where business was discussed. The evidence, however, is that the scheme was hatched by others, by Mr. Dalglish and by Mr. Prudenza, and that they then met with Anderson. Lennox, at one point, who was sort of running the operation, met with Mr. Anderson at one point. And then there's also evidence in the record that Mr. Prudenza kept Mr. Anderson updated to some degree, although there is no evidence as to what they talked about in their interactions. And there's testimony that some of their interactions were social as well. Mr. Prudenza, I believe, testified that he was in approximately weekly contact with Mr. Anderson during the enterprise, but he did not testify as to the nature of those conversations. The second enhancement that we challenge is a perjury enhancement. We claim that under the principles from Buchanan, where an enhancement is not supposed to punish testimony, it's not supposed to be automatic when a defendant testifies, and a guilty verdict doesn't mean that there was perjury, applying those principles here, we would submit that the court was erroneous in imposing a perjury enhancement in this case. The second set of sentencing issues that we raise are the substantive unreasonableness of the sentence. We understand that the court is reluctant to overturn district court's rulings on sentences and that there are some good reasons for that. However, the Supreme Court imposes upon this court a responsibility to consider under an abuse of discretion standard whether a sentence is substantively unreasonable.
It's like a below guidelines sentence. So that's
correct.
A tough argument to make when you've got a below-guideline sentence.
You are correct. However, in this case, we would argue one of the reasons was because the guidelines were improperly calculated. And so if you accept our argument on that, it would have not been below the guidelines. In addition, the Third Circuit recently held, and we submitted a 28J letter because this decision just came out April 16th, in the Olfhofsky case, that a below-sentence guideline was substantively unreasonable. And I think that although the facts are somewhat different, the analysis in that case is very applicable here because that decision emphasizes that this court has to look at whether the district court properly applied the factors in 3553A, including whether the court considered the individual characteristics of the defendant properly. This is a case where Mr. Anderson was sentenced to 280 months, which translates into more than 23 years in prison. And we've illustrated in several ways in our brief why that is problematic. I mean, first, that creates significant disparities with other sentencing. If you look at the other sentences that were before the district court, for example, the PSR noted that five defendants had been sentenced under the telemarketing provisions or telemarketing fraud statute since 2005. Those sentences were something like 11 months, 36 months, and then 156 months was the greatest. Here we're substantially above that.
But what was driving this sentence was the massive amount of the loss, as I understand it.
Which is one factor that of course, it goes into consideration. However, while the loss amount overall was very large, the individual loss was not. Each victim, while we don't mean to diminish the crime, was only out of about $200.
An awful lot of people got hurt.
That is certainly the case, and I think that the district court considered that. However, what was not appropriately considered was that Mr. Anderson had no criminal history whatsoever. Even the district court found that he was to some extent a dupe, at least at the beginning of this conspiracy.
The beginning doesn't count. It's where you end up.
I certainly understand your position. However, if you look at recidivism likelihood, Mr. Anderson is 56 years old. He operated a legitimate business for 30 years. There's not a significant likelihood that he would do anything other than return to that life in Canada, but he's in prison for 23 years. If you look at people like Bernard Ebers and Jeffrey Skilling, that's the level of sentence that Mr. Anderson was, where this court was at with the sentence. And, this was an $8 million fraud, which is certainly significant, but it's nothing like the billion-dollar frauds that that were at issue in those types of cases. So we think that that warrants also vacating and remanding the sentence.
Is your client serving a sentence in the United States or Canada?
I'm sorry?
Is your client serving in...
He's serving in the United States near the Canadian border.
Will he be transferred at the end of his appeal?
I do not know the answer.
To Canadian authorities?
I do not know.
Why I ask is that apparently was true of one of his confederates, which was not with respect to an earlier crime.
I believe Mr. Prudenza was convicted in the United States and transferred to serve part of that sentence in Canada.
Thanks.
That's correct. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Is it Ruppert?
I am not going to address sufficiency unless the court has questions about the record. I'm going to move into the sentencing issues. With respect to Mr. Anderson's leadership role, we cited the Howe case decided by this court on May 29th of 2008, and it lays out five or seven factors, first of which the exercise of decision-making authority. To be sure, that occurred early on. It also occurred during the 4 to 6 weeks that Prudenza and Dalglish were in Italy. Two, the nature of participation in the commission of the offense. Well, he bankrolled this scam. The record is very clear that the principals did not have the financial wherewithal to even establish bank accounts. So they could not have established relationships with payment processors in order to get victims' funds without Mr. Anderson bankrolling the scheme. Three, the recruitment of accomplices. There was testimony below by Mr. Lennox that he met directly with Mr. Anderson, and he was angling for a recruitment bonus, which was promised by Mr. Anderson. So he had a role, Mr. Anderson had a role in the recruitment of accomplices. Four, the claimed right to a larger share of the fruits of the crime. At any one time, there were probably between 150 and 200 people involved in this scam on the phones. Mr. Anderson was one of three people that shared the profits. Five, the degree of participation in planning and organizing the offense. Again, that occurred at the beginning when Mr. Anderson bankrolled the scheme. There was evidence in the record that when the scheme ran into problems because payment processors were shutting them down because of consumer complaints. Mr. Anderson attended one of these management meetings and promised to stand behind the paychecks of the room managers in the event that they lost the bank. Nature and scope of illegal activities, this was obviously massive. The degree of control and authority exercised over others. Now, to be sure, his level of control and authority was not the same as Dalglish and Mr. Prudenza. But nevertheless, this was a massive scheme involving dozens and dozens and dozens of people operating at its height from seven rooms throughout the Toronto area, each of which had at any one time dozens of telemarketers on the phone. He was clearly in charge during the 4 to 6 weeks that Prudenza and Dalglish were in Italy. He was clearly at least played a role when he was attending these management meetings and identified as a principal. The Howe case, in terms of this authority and control, as I read the case, made it clear that this was not the sine qua non of liability for enhancement. Matter of fact, this court indicated that the central concern of 3B1.1 is, in fact, the relative responsibility for the offense. Given the dozens and dozens of people involved in the offense, the fact that Mr. Anderson bankrolled it and continued to have substantial involvement on it in a management setting, and in addition to that, got a third of the profits, we think within the meaning of how the district court properly applied the three-level enhancement. Now, with respect to the substantive reasonableness of the sentence, I would submit to the court, notwithstanding the attempt by Mr. Anderson below to posture this as essentially a garden variety fraud, this is an extreme outlier so far as fraud is concerned. I addressed during the sentencing below, and it's discussed in detail in a sentencing memorandum and objections to or response to Anderson's objections to the pre-sentence investigation report, document 162 below, and I addressed this at sentencing, that there were 40,000 victims in this case. In order to sell this stuff to 40,000 victims, they had to make many, many more telephone calls than the 40,000 in order to achieve this level of success. Both Mr. Lennox and Mr. Prudenza testified below that for every 100 outbound calls, they would close between 1 and 5 sales. Assuming a population as of 2004 of 218 million adults in the United States, that meant that First Capital may have attempted to defraud 1 out of every 55 adults in the United States, at least between 1 out of 55 and 1 out of 273 adults, based on near contemporaneous census figures. When one looks at household figures, it's between 1 out of every 19 households in the United States and 1 out of every 95. We cited below during the sentencing hearing to a Federal Trade Commission study of consumer fraud victimization in the United States, and the citation to that is also in document 162 below. Federal Trade Commission determined that about 2% of the entire population of the United States in any one year back in, I think the year of study was 2002, that 2% of the over 2% of the population of the United States had been victimized in a scheme like this. So we view this as an extreme outlier so far as offenses are concerned. As to the argument that this was not like the Enron case, I agree this is not like the Enron case, because Enron at least was a legitimate business, engaged in a legitimate business, although perhaps by illegitimate means. This was an absolute outright flim-flam. There was nothing being sold. It was a complete cheat from the very beginning. So this makes it different even from the garden variety securities fraud. As to the argument that the nature of the losses two individual victims was not a life-altering situation. I agree with that. However, the evidence was that this did target people who had credit problems. I address below in document 162 and cite to some studies done of people who have filed bankruptcy, and there are some law review articles done on something called the Bankruptcy Project. We don't know, this is not necessarily the same population, people with credit problems versus people who have filed bankruptcy, but I think we all intuitively understand there's a relationship. And what the Bankruptcy Project found is there are a lot of people file for bankruptcy because, not because of their inability to control their spending habits, but a life-altering event, medical problem, loss of a job, or a divorce. Bankruptcy disproportionately affects single women with children. And so in the context of somebody who is really tapped out and is looking for this lifeline of this credit card that is going to be provided to them at a price of $150, $219 or so, that this amount of money actually probably represents a substantial part of the amount of money that that individual family probably has on hand when they receive this credit card. Now multiply that by 40,000, and we're talking about a great deal of misery. If there are no questions from the court, I would submit to you that the district court properly found that the role in the offense, the findings were not clearly erroneous. This below-guideline sentence was reasonable.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Brennan, you have 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. In terms of the enhancement for management or supervision, counsel went through the other factors at issue. First, I would say that control is still required, and it has to be control over another participant. That, for the reasons I previously stated, was not found. In addition, I would ask the court to look at our brief with respect to the other factors because we've laid out there why we believe that they also do not support the enhancement here. In particular, we don't think that the record fairly supports that he was involved in recruiting any other accomplices.
Well, he did send the letter to, I think it was Prudenza, who was in prison at the time, to facilitate his early release on parole.
Well, we would submit
that he had a job for him.
We would submit that the record doesn't support that he was doing that for the purpose of trying to spring him from prison to be part of the scheme. The letter simply stated that he would provide a job for him in his home improvement business, and the evidence in the records is that Mr. Dowdlish asked him to provide that record or to provide that letter.
Did he ever work in the home improvement business?
He did not actually ever work in the home improvement business, but at the time that he wrote the letter, we believe that that was the intention and that he was doing it as a favor to Mr. Dowdlish, and we believe that's fairly supported by the record.
They had discussed this plan to start this new business, though, hadn't
they?
Dowdlish
and Mr. Prudenza had discussed it. There's no evidence in the record that by that point Mr. Anderson was aware of anything that was going on with the scheme.
Well, he had agreed to put up money by that point, right?
I don't believe it's clear in the record that he had at that point agreed to make the loan. I believe that the record does show that Mr. Dowdlish visited Mr. Prudenza and said that he thought he had a backer, but at that time he didn't name the backer, the financial backer. So it's unclear whether Mr. Anderson had actually agreed to put up money at that point.
But he didn't actually have this job available for him in his legitimate business at the time he wrote the letter.
The record does not indicate that. The only evidence, I believe, on that point was Mr. Anderson's own testimony, and he did not say that he would not have hired him or provided a job for him in his home improvement business. He does say that he did not ultimately hire him to do so.
So there's nothing that suggests that this job did not exist, that the only job...
I don't believe that there is anything that shows that this job did not exist at the time that Mr. Anderson wrote the letter. And if the court has no further questions, I see that my time is up.
Thank you. And Ms. Brennan, you were appointed counsel for Mr. Anderson, correct?
Yes.
All right. You have the thanks of the court for your service to your client and the court. And our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.